Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Life Science Report, a podcast from Back Bay Life Science Advisors. My name is Pete Bach, and I'm a managing director here at Back Bay in Boston. And today, as usual, for our monthly chit-chat, I'm joined by my colleague and director at Back Bay, Christian Thienel. Welcome.
Thanks, Pete. Always a good time to be on with you.
Yes, yes, indeed. So today, we wanted to talk about an area that, you know, in maybe 24 months ago or, you know, 36 months ago was the topic du jour, but sort of wanted to revisit it and see what's been happening in the vaccine space. So obviously with the advent of COVID-19 in 2020 and 2021, we saw a tremendous amount of interest in not only vaccines for COVID, but a lot of companies, you know, jumping on that tailwind and developing therapies across other viral illnesses, maternal infections, bacterial infections. So today, we won't be talking about COVID or flu that much, which are sort of the two most advanced or mature viral disease markets at this point, but wanted to dive into a few other up-and-coming areas and technologies, particularly respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, which has a couple of interesting developments in the past year or so, as well as some other areas where there's late stage clinical development activity, and we're seeing a lot of interest. So maybe just to start us off today, and normally I let Christian talk, but I'm taking, as the resident immunologist, going to take over at the outset. I thought just it'd be useful to sort of lay out a few of the different vaccine types, because I think we'll talk a little bit about that when we get into specific markets, how folks are thinking about the pros and cons of various types of vaccines and how they provide a product market fit based on, you know, the underlying technology itself, and then, you know, how that results in different immunologic responses and how that lines up with the underlying viral diseases. So when we think about vaccines, there's a few different types. Obviously, the goal is to, you know, mimic a viral or bacterial or any other pathogenic infection and get the immune response to react to it. So as such, you know, you're looking to introduce some sort of viral or bacterial particle to mimic an element of that, you know, pathogen that the immune response can identify and react to. So historically, when we've talked about vaccines, they've largely been either inactivated or live attenuated vaccines. So those are the actual pathogen that has either been chemically inactivated, you know, and made unable to replicate in the body, or, you know, attenuated vaccines through various means. Vaccine manufacturers basically have a live vaccine, but it has been broken, debilitated, you know, made non-pathogenic in some way, shape, or form, such that you're introducing the whole bacteria or virus. These are mainly virus products in these two categories that the immune response reacts to. And then sort of the next level or you know, the next vaccine type that has historically been developed is subunit vaccines. And so these are taking, you know, individual protein particles, introducing them into the human with a little bit of an adjuvant to get the immune response ramped up. And that's a topic for a whole nother podcast. We won't be talking about adjuvants today. But again, so those are essentially parts of a bacteria or a virus that will, again, get the immune response to recognize it such that it's able to fight off the whole bacteria, whole virus subsequently. And then we get to, you know, what everyone was reading about and learning about and developing during the pandemic, and that is nucleic acid vaccines. So those are, you know, the Moderna and the Pfizer BioNTech vaccines, where basically you introduce a piece of nucleic acid, be it DNA, or in the cases of those vaccines, RNA, and basically get the, you know, human cells to make those proteins such that the immune response would subsequently mount a response against it. So you could think about it, you know, to a greater or lesser degree, almost as one step up from a subunit vaccine, such that you're letting the body produce the antigen against which you'll mount an immune response. So then another one that is type of vaccine that has been out there as well and is sort of gaining popularity again is the virus-like particle. So those are basically, you know, proteins that have been engineered to assemble into a virus shell, you could think about it, such that the body will respond to it. So unlike an inactivated or attenuated vaccine, you're basically synthetically making a virus particle and then introducing it into the bodies. And these can be engineered in a variety of different ways. So, you know, you have a lot of well-behaved viruses that you can make in this way and then engineer another virus protein on the outside. So you could think about it, you know, you can make a particle of virus A and then paint it, so to speak, with an antigen of virus B and mounted immune response. And some of those, you know, historically have been your Hep B vaccines as well as your HPV Gardasil, for example, as well. So some of that will be important as we go on, especially as we think about, you know, some of the protein or virus-like particle vaccines relative to the nucleic acid vaccines, as they have varying levels of durability. And I'll sort of tease that and plant that in everyone's mind before we go on.
It was a nice overview, Pete. Took a lot of notes on that one.
Okay, good. There'll be a quiz later, Christian. So I think the first one, the first virus in area we wanted to tackle is RSV. And I will, if you'll bear with me a little bit longer, I'll sort of give a tour of the RSV space. Again, with flu and COVID, it's another respiratory virus that's fairly common. And, you know, similar to some of the other common respiratory viral diseases, it causes cold-like symptoms, coughing, sneezing, wheezing. I think, you know, for most healthy people, again, similar to the situation with flu, you know, they'll recover in a couple of weeks. However, you know, severe RSV infections can lead to hospitalization and death, especially in folks with compromised or weakened immune system. So certainly the elderly as well as infants. So interestingly, you know, this is a very common disease in children. So about 90% of children are infected with RSV within the first 2 years of life. And, you know, obviously older children and adults are also infected, but, you know, the disease course is less severe or less prominent. And then the other main risk population, as I said, are the children under 2 years old and over 65 years old. So it's quite a common disease. So the, you know, about 12% of acute respiratory disease visits are expected to be from or caused by RSV. You know, again, within that older population, you know, there's anywhere from 150 to 200,000 RSV hospitalizations in that older over 65 population. So, and again, worldwide, about 64 million people annually get an RSV infection, and it causes about 160,000 deaths a year. So again, not only is there high morbidity and mortality, but again, it causes hospitalization, higher healthcare costs. Again, it's estimated for, you know, some of the health economic research has shown that, you know, for an elderly person with an RSV infection, total healthcare costs can be almost double for those individuals relative to controls without RSV. So this has been a problem historically, even before the resurgence in vaccine interest, and sort of given that very vulnerable population, again, the infants and elderly, there's been a number of developments within sort of the treatment space. So similar to the COVID situation, there's a number of antibodies that have been developed for the treatment of RSV, most notably Beyfortus by Sanofi. So that's a human monoclonal antibody that blocks one of the proteins on the outside of RSV that helps it enter the cell. So that's a one dose antibody given to, again, at-risk folks. And in 2023, they did about, you know, 500 million, 600 million in sales and projected to grow by a couple hundred million each year going forward. There's also a product co-developed by Sobi and NEZ called Synagis. And again, that's indicated for children. That's a multi-dose product. And again, looking at some of the data between those two assets, you know, in the last year or so, looking at sort of weekly script volume, it obviously changes seasonally a little bit. You know, they were treating anywhere at peak, you know, peak seasonal infections, treating anywhere from, you know, 50 to 75,000 patients a week. So that's a little background. And obviously, given the importance and severity of that disease and the reach into vulnerable populations, there's been a lot of interest in vaccine development. Maybe Christian, you can sort of walk us through that.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I think exactly to, you know, building off that, Pete. So, you know, you have the antibodies that are available more in the kind of treatment or prophylactic, you know, and I think they are more thought of for, you know, use in kind of pediatric patients and you know, young children. Really the vaccine development so far, you know, there's also some development towards, you know, child vaccines, but it's primarily been for, you know, adults 60 and over, you know, generally targeting, yeah, older individuals for RSV vaccination. There's been two kind of key ones that have launched recently. So you have the Arexvy from GSK and Abrysvo from Pfizer. Those are both, you know, protein subunit vaccines targeting, you know, prefusion F antigen. And, you know, they had very, you know, very good data from their phase three trials with a benefit in, you know, lower respiratory tract infections caused by RSV. I think that, you know, there were some questions about how that would play out in terms of, you know, first couple of RSV seasons and how that looks in terms of long-term immunization, and which, you know, there was some data that came out recently as well that ACIP came out with that was interesting there, which we'll get to in a second. And then you also have some other, you know, several other players here as well that have development stage programs. So Moderna is bringing forward an mRNA-based vaccine, which, you know, as I think we'll also talk about in terms of the, you know, one of the things that is traditionally a challenge with nucleic acid-based vaccines is the sort of durability of response, which is okay when you have something like a, you know, like a COVID or a flu that is seasonal and very predictable and that, you know, happens every year annually. Whereas RSV, there are seasons, but it's not as, oh, it's getting cold out, time to get the RSV shot. That gets much more variable in terms of when those seasons happen. So I think that there's some kind of interesting things we'll talk about in terms of how that, you know, has some impact. And then you also have other players here, you know, J&J, Bavarian Nordic, Novavax, you know, again, with their kind of VLP based vaccines. So, you know, quite a bit of activity in the RSV space on the vaccine front. In terms of the, you know, the ones that have launched recently, they've been pretty successful. We've seen, you know, vaccine rates for RSV of about 22% in 2023, 2024, which continues to grow. I think the sort of interesting thing is that some of the data from ACIP that recently came out showed, you know, efficacy over two seasons for each of the products. And so far, you know, GSK's Arexvy has been very much the market leader here with, I think, about 70% of retail pharmacy scripts and then 55% of kind of usage in medical offices.
Yeah.
But it's actually, you know, if you look at the data from the, you know, first to second season, you know, level of efficacy, there's actually quite a bit better performance with Abrysvo, with the Pfizer vaccine. So I think it's interesting to see, you know, how this, you know, how things potentially change in terms of, you know, any kind of preference based on the kind of durability and the efficacy there. They both saw a drop from, you know, season one to season two, as you might expect, but a much more pronounced one with the GSK vaccine. So it's interesting. Yeah, we'll sort of see how that, if that materially impacts kind of real world utilization of those. And I think the other key thing that came out of ACIP was some of the data around Guillain-Barré syndrome. So, you know, there were a few cases in, you know, in both of the sort of cohorts with kind of Arexvy and Abrysvo of GBS that were kind of above the kind of expected amount. I think that they would have expected around, you know, three or four cases in among all the sort of case, you know, numbers of patients that have been treated. They saw, you know, basically a 10 in the Arexvy group and 25 with Abrysvo. So I think that was some of the recent data that came out, I think just this past week, about, you know, to what extent that is a safety concern, how that might impact utilization. Yeah. So I think we'll see, you know, I think there's, given the rates, there's certainly some pushback from the companies in terms of how significant of a risk that really is. But I, you know, do think it's something that, for something like this, that's very broad-based, obviously, is going to play a role in, you know, reaching patients that might be hesitant to get it or might not be as motivated.
Yeah. And maybe just to jump in quickly. For those not familiar with the acronym, ACIP is the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. So that's a working group in the CDC, and they are the folks making all the recommendations as far as vaccine schedules, specific populations, et cetera. So again, they work, it's a parallel guidance once a vaccine is registered and approved by the FDA. And we'll talk a little bit about that sort of the implication to ACIP recommendations from some of the commercial dynamics as we go on.
Yeah, I think an interesting thing with the group too is that they rarely provide any sort of recommendation of one vaccine over another in a given class. But I think, you know, with the emerging data here, I think it'll be interesting to see whether there is any differential view from ACIP in terms of whether there's a preference. I think you have obviously the better durability data with the Pfizer vaccine, but potentially higher GBS risk. So it, you know, might not be enough to move the needle there. But I think that is something that folks are keeping an eye on as more data matures here.
Yeah. And then you mentioned at the outset here about Moderna. So maybe you can talk a little bit about what they're doing in the space here.
Sure. So I think that they're in a phase 3 study now for their RSV vaccine. And I think the interesting thing that they're doing is, you know, obviously they have their, you know, COVID and flu vaccines. And a key part of, I think, of their strategy, and it's sort of see from their pipeline, is really these kind of vaccine combos, and really the triple combo of COVID, flu, and RSV, I think, is a key one that they're focused on. And the interesting thing, I think, from our perspective there is that, you know, as I kind of mentioned before, you know, COVID and flu would be, you know, vaccines that you get yearly. You know, there's boosters, a sort of regular dosing schedule with those based on, you know, very predictable seasonality. You know, RSV does have seasons, but it's not, you know, every year you get a vaccine. There's a different type of a schedule there. And I think one of the shortfalls of RNA-based vaccines has been kind of the durability and the need to get kind of regular, regular boosters or revaccination, which fits pretty well with some of these seasonal infections, but less so with something like an RSV. But by doing this triple combo where you have folks coming in already for, you know, COVID and flu vaccine, you know, it's sort of solving that problem in terms of any potential durability challenges, because they're, you know, going to be seeing them regularly anyway. You can sort of continue to boost them. So it sort of makes a fit for a modality that, you know, wouldn't on the surface, you would think would be the best suited based on just, you know, purely the kind of fundamentals here. But
And I think, again, it's not just the seasonality, but it's also the antigen and strain issue, right? So just to take a step back on, you know, COVID and flu, they're, you know, most respiratory viral diseases tend to be, you know, seasonal for a variety of reasons. But as we, you know, all learned during COVID, you get sort of various strains as they mutate out in the wild. So it's not just seasonality, but each season with COVID, you're going to see potentially different strains and therefore need a new vaccine. And, you know, we're also familiar with, you know, the updates to the flu vaccine every year and sort of the various combos of H's and N's, like, you know, H1N1 and all that. And that's due to sort of the biology and the reassortment of the flu virus, such that, again, you need a different, you know, you need to vaccinate against different antigens every year. So you have sort of, you know, in this state of play, two viruses that you need to update every year. And I think as we saw in the case of COVID, that, you know, was very well suited to the RNA-based approach where you can quickly, you know, shuffle in, you know, the different codons for different antigens, but then you pair that with something that is seasonal but doesn't have the same breadth of antigenicity or strain variability. So you've got sort of COVID and flu, which you need to change every year. And then the thinking is you probably don't need to do that with RSV, where, you know, potentially something more durable would be more than appropriate.
Right.
But you've got sort of the RNA vaccines, which, you know, their efficacy wanes. So it's sort of an interesting, you know, chess game, I guess, against, you know, the viral biology matched against the sort of product and how you're vaccinating, where that, you know, speed and being able to update the vaccine for COVID and flu is an advantage and maybe a disadvantage for something, even if it is seasonal, that doesn't change.
Yeah.
And we'll get to how that may play out with a couple other viruses moving forward. So,
yep.
So I think in that vein, maybe we can talk about two other ones that are, you know, even earlier or less mature as a sure. as a vaccine market, and that's CMV and EBV.
Yeah. So I think, you know, CMV, I think, is one that, yeah, certainly has seen quite a lot of interest on, you know, the vaccine side. I think it's also come into play, you know, quite a bit, certainly in a lot of the work that we've done and, you know, the sort of prophylaxis and treatment space for recurrent or reactivated infections, particularly in the transplant space. So for anyone that's not familiar with cytomegalovirus, you know, it's one of the most common causes of congenital infection. It's generally transmitted to a developing baby via the placenta, and it's extremely common. You have basically 50 or as many as 85% of the U.S. population is infected with CMV. It's typically latent, doesn't cause any symptoms in the vast majority of individuals. But because as I was just mentioning, when you're thinking about an immunocompromised patient population, that might be, you know, somebody receiving a solid organ or a bone marrow transplant, or kind of on any sort of long-term immunosuppression for, you know, other types of diseases, it can be is an elevated risk of reactivation of infection, and there's quite a bit of you know, potential risk and morbidity that mm-hmm. comes along with that. And you also have the sort of angle of the potential infection in infants. So you have the potential for yeah. kind of, you know, birth defects and other kind of complications in newborns. And it's, you know, relatively rare that that, you know, newborns develop, you know, a CMV infection. But if they do occur, you know, they can cause cognitive impairment, you know, cerebral mm-hmm. palsy, seizures,
yeah.
all sorts of other complications. So there's been a lot of focus, and I think a lot of it so far, again, on the kind of prophylaxis and treatment side, is focused on the transplant space, as that's been a kind of defined population there. But as you think towards vaccine development, a lot of that has been towards, you know, how do we vaccinate against this as early as possible, which really yeah. is kind of looking towards either maternal vaccines or vaccines in women of childbearing potential. So there currently aren't any prophylactic vaccines, you know, against CMV, another leader here being Moderna with the most advanced one. So they have a, you know, prophylactic vaccine that is targeting two CMV surface proteins that are critical for infection. Essentially, the difficulty here, again, has been, do you think about a maternal vaccine, which is yeah. very complicated and having a lot of challenges related to, you know, studying a population of pregnant women from a regulatory and sort of development risk perspective? There's all kinds of challenges there, not only, you know, the sort of safety element of it for the mother as well as the child. But you have mm-hmm. a lot of increased, you know, kind of regulatory requirements there for yeah. safety and things, which just really increases the complexity and cost of doing those studies. And so the focus that Moderna has taken has been on women of childbearing potential with a kind of 16 to 40 year old age population. And they've mm-hmm. fully enrolled their phase three in the cohort of, you know, women over 18 years old. And the data is expected to, or at least the study is expected to complete in 2026. So it is on the pretty near term horizon here of, you know, what this would look like and what the impact is going to be. Obviously, I think that there would be, you know, widespread impact here, not only on, you know, the immediate benefit in terms of, you know, childhood mortality for newborns and the complications of infection, but also how does that affect things down the road in terms of, you know, there's quite a bit of a market around the kind of, you know, transplant-related anti-infectives.
Yeah.
And again, the kind of infectious or recurrent infections in immunocompromised patients. And does this have, you know, would take a longer time for that to play out, but a very clear impact there sort of downstream as well.
Yeah. And that's one area where actually even before Moderna got involved here, people were trying to vaccinate in and around transplant patients. And that has been difficult, obviously,
right.
because depending on the type of transplant you're getting, you're highly immunosuppressed. So it's mainly been, you know, therapeutic for CMV on the transplant side. But I think this is an interesting population and way to navigate this market. And one other interesting thing, getting back to the concept of durability versus antigenicity and need to switch up the vaccines as things evolve or change, this is a market where it's not expected to, you know, you're not expected to need to update the vaccine every year. So you've got a potential modality that again, you may need to be boosted every once in a while for a virus that isn't going to change or mutate that much. Yeah. And so as a result, you've got a couple other players entering the space earlier that may offer, you know, remains to be seen, a differentiated sort of vaccination or dosing schedule, you know, and a couple virus-like particle players starting to begin in phase one study, most notably a UK biotech SpyBio there. So will be interesting to see how this evolves.
Yeah, from what you mentioned at the outset in terms of, you know, how the kind of pandemic has really sparked a lot of interest here, I think this area, and we'll talk about a couple of other ones, in terms of these really large indications with huge trials where you're having to do, again, either like maternal vaccines or, you know, women of childbearing potential, very, you know, onerous development programs might not have been things that people thought about, you know, 10 years ago because of the sort of cost and risk and things. But I think as, you know, not only nucleic acid, but other modalities of vaccines have advanced and there is more interest in this space, I think, you know, this is, I think you could draw a pretty direct line from that to, you know, these other indications. So it's interesting.
One other interesting one, which we want to talk about is EBV. So it's another one that probably a lot of people are familiar with, maybe not specifically, but familiar with some of the consequences of EBV and sort of a different, call it value proposition or what, you know, sort of disease type or disease course that you're trying to prevent here. So maybe talk a little bit about that, Christian.
Yeah. So I think this is another, you know, example of, Epstein-Barr being an extremely prevalent, you know, infection. You know, infectious mononucleosis is kind of the most common clinical manifestation of EBV, which, you know, many people may be familiar with, but, you know, you have a sort of fever, pharyngitis, a lot of fatigue, you know, basically, you know, prolonged flu-like symptoms over a longer period of time. And I think what one of the really interesting things here has been some of the recent data around the links to EBV infection and other downstream consequences and disease progression, which most notably have been, you know, MS or multiple sclerosis and other sort of, you know, development of cancers. The MS data was really interesting in that there was a very, very large longitudinal study of, you know, over 10 million young adults on, I think it was active duty U.S. military, that saw basically a 32-fold increase in risk of developing MS after infection with EBV. So I think, you know, not only, you know, thinking about, you know, mononucleosis and the sort of immediate impacts of infection, but also these downstream consequences have, I think, created a lot of additional interest here in looking at EBV as another, you know, potential source of targeting for vaccination. There's also been quite a bit of data that's come out of the pandemic in that, you know, COVID-19 infection has found to be associated with reactivation of Epstein-Barr virus as well. And so just given, obviously, the prevalence of that, I think the thought is that the potential impacts here from EBV are, you know, more what we are better understood now and also going to be relatively prevalent as things move forward. So, you know, a few years ago you had only Moderna and another, you know, Grid Biosciences, another company that were, you know, developing vaccines towards EBV. But in the past couple of years, you've seen, you know, Big Pharma make a pretty concerted effort to get involved here as well. Most notably, you know, Merck licensed a preclinical EBV vaccine in March of 2023 from Modex Therapeutics, which was a $50 million upfront licensing transaction, which, you know, for a preclinical vaccine is pretty good. So I think that, you know, not getting into the sort of dynamics of the particular transaction here, but I think conceptually it really represents, you know, this is an area that is really, you know, becoming more of interest on your typical vaccine players and not more of a, you know, we'll sort of see what happens with poking around on early stage programs. I think it's very much more kind of translating into, you know, this is going to be sort of the next one coming up with these sort of large clinical studies.
Yeah. So I know we want to save some time for talking about pricing and reimbursement and some commercial issues here, but maybe, you know, very briefly, we've talked a lot about viruses. Maybe you can speak just quickly about people and where the space is with bacterial
disease. So two quick highlights on that front there. Yeah. So on the bacterial side, I think, you know, one company that, you know, we're really familiar with and an area that we've looked at quite a bit is sort of Group B strep, you know, very sort of prevalent bacterial infection that is, you know, one of the leading causes of life-threatening infections in newborns. You have an extremely high burden in Africa where, you know, over 50% of invasive GBS cases are, and over 60% of all fetal or infant deaths due to GBS occur there. I think this is an interesting one where, you know, Minervax is the company specifically that's kind of leading the way here with a maternal vaccine for GBS. And you know, I think they recently closed a, you know, very large Series B round. I think it was 54 million euros. And it's a company that we've known and supported. And I think, you know, as they move into, you know, potential pivotal studies here, I think that's a really interesting one where, again, you think about a, you know, maternal vaccine population, all the complications that go along with it there, but they've been continuously successful and have been able to draw quite a bit of interest from some of the largest investors in healthcare and biotech. So I think that's a really interesting one to keep an eye on. And then the other one being pneumococcal disease, which is a very different, you know, type of a case where you've had vaccines available, you know, against that infection for many years, with, you know, Pfizer's Prevnar 13 being the most known one. They had Prevnar 20 come out recently, and the main difference there being the sort of coverage of specific serotypes there. And that's been one of the main challenges with pneumococcal disease, is that there's over 90 identified serotypes. Most infections are caused by about 23 of them, but you know, the more coverage you have, the better chance you have of having, you know, a more durable immunization there. And that's really been the focus of a lot of the more recent development stage activity, has been broadening coverage. So you have Affinivax and Astellas and Vaxcyte with 24 valent candidates. Pfizer has complementary candidates that they're thinking about adding on to their Prevnar products that increase their serotype coverage. So again, really competitive space, but is a very, you know, has been a very, very lucrative one for Pfizer as well over the years. So we'll see how things play out there in terms of, you know, whether these newer vaccines that have, you know, better valence and coverage are able to, you know, potentially take some share away from Prevnar, and vice versa, whether they're able to stave that off at Pfizer.
Yeah. And maybe I can just anecdotally throw in a couple comments here before we move to pricing and reimbursement. And that's sort of from a company capitalization, you know, and sort of the life cycle of a biotech company developing vaccines. It's much different to a greater or lesser degree than a lot of the other therapeutic areas for treatments that we look at, because of, you know, as you brought up, in a lot of these studies, it's fairly large trials to demonstrate a difference, especially in prevention, since, you know, as you include folks in a trial, not everyone is necessarily going to catch a disease or have pathology, regardless of whether they've gotten the vaccine. So, you know, a lot of these companies, because of that, have gone public, sort of to access the capital markets and larger funding requirements for those trials, and or have been bought by some of the large players. And it's not, again, because of those resources, there aren't a ton of counterparties that are going to play, because not everyone has a vaccine franchise. Obviously, that's changed a bit, and there's been some renewed interest given COVID. But strategically, it's a very interesting question for companies to think through as they're charting their growth. And again, you know, some of these large players are continuing, you know, to be interested in the space. You mentioned the Merck deal. I think also recently AstraZeneca bought a company called Acosavax. Again, they're a VLP-based company developing assets for RSV, as well as another disease called human metapneumovirus. And, you know, that was a fairly large deal. Icosavax, again, was a public company, and AZ bought them, you know, for about, I think it was $800 million, which was about a 43% premium to their market cap with some CVRs. So maybe you can talk to, again, this is a different space for therapeutics with respect to pricing and reimbursement, maybe sort of touch on those issues as it pertains to sort of the commercial case for these assets.
Sure. Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, the long and the short of it, I think, is really that, as we talked about before, the kind of, you know, ACIP, or, you know, Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, comes out with guidelines about, you know, which, you know, particular, you know, areas where there are, you know, approved vaccines for that are recommended, you know, by them. And generally speaking, you know, reimbursement decision making is pretty straightforward from the U.S. payer point of view, in that, similarly to in many oncology areas, where if the NCCN guidelines recommend a certain therapy, it is generally covered. That is also the case with respect to, you know, if ACIP recommends a certain vaccine is used in a certain population that it is indicated for, or, you know, it is supported by data, generally payers are following that, and there's not a lot of, you know, active tracking of costs or management. Aside from, you know, there's been a lot of view on the COVID-19 vaccine, I think, just given that that's one that, you know, is obviously, you know, came up very quickly and turned into a large budget item, particularly after, you know, the kind of emergency use and sort of federal emergency expired, where that then became onto the budget of private payers in the U.S. But generally speaking, you know, there's not a lot of active tracking of these spaces. You generally, given that the populations are so large, they're not you know, particularly expensive. I'm Payer will probably not agree with me saying that, but generally speaking, you know, these are on relatively low orders of magnitude in terms of overall cost. I think, you know, you have not as many issues there related to basically coverage as you have in the therapeutic side, where you have much more sort of contracting, preferred access, positioning, all that sort of stuff. You basically have a lot more of, you know, there's vaccines here, we cover them, and that's sort of it. If there's anything here that becomes an issue we're not seeing the value on, they might kind of reactively look at things like that. But in terms of, you know, proactive management, is really not a space where that happens. The complex thing, I think, comes on when you have, you know, the sort of CMS side and the public payer part, where you're having, you know, to put in agreed prices with them, where there's, you know, obviously contracting with a, you know, single payer or a very consolidated one for large portions of the population, particularly as, you know, we think about some of the RSV vaccines targeting folks over 60, where Medicare is going to be the predominant payer for that. You know, I think then it becomes a bit more of a challenge in, you know, how do you make a budget impact sort of argument towards CMS, which is, you know, certainly going to be more cost conscious towards this sort of thing than a private payer would be. But in general, it's, I think a relatively favorable environment, at least in the US, as far as, you know, comparatively speaking goes.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Well, I'm looking at the clock and I think this could be one of the longer ones we've recorded, Christian. And I think we've left a lot on the floor that we could go back and revisit or dive into. And probably a lot of that was giving me the mic at the outset. But regardless, a pleasure as always. Christian, thanks for joining.
Yeah, of course.
And if you have any questions about biopharma and medtech development, partnering, M&A, licensing, head over to the podcast page on our website and submit a question at www.bblsa.com/podcasts. That's bblsa.com/podcast. Your question may be a topic for an upcoming podcast. Thank you for joining us and look forward to the next time.